Okay, so I'm here with Dr. Simon Stott from Cambridge University. Simon, could you please introduce yourself to the listeners?
Hi, everybody. I'm Simon Stott from Cambridge University. And I'm a research scientist who does both lab and clinic-based research on Parkinson's. And I run a small little website called The Science of Parkinson's, where I try to explain in plain English, what's going on in the research world with regards to Parkinson's, basically just language that my mum will understand.
And yeah, that website is really the main, not that your clinical work isn't, or your lab work isn't important as well, but that website is the main reason why I wanted to talk to you today, just because it is such a bastion of information for so many people with Parkinson's disease. I thought it was just worth hearing a little bit of the backstory and getting a little bit of a better sense of how that came about and where that was going. So I guess the first question I wanted to ask is, I mean, I'm sure you have a very busy schedule as it is with all the lab work that you have to do. What was it that compelled you to spend so much time trying to communicate the science of Parkinson's disease?
So about 3 years ago, I approached my boss, Professor Roger Barker, about getting in the clinic. We have weekly clinics for Parkinson's here, where we run assessments and also run clinical studies and clinical trials. And after 10 years or so of studying Parkinson's, I realized that I hadn't really spent much time with the condition itself. And we were understaffed in the clinic, and so he was very happy to take on extra hands. And it was an opportunity to get up close and personal with the condition that I've been studying. And it's been eye-opening. But through that process, I realized that there's an enormous thirst for information, and people will go to strange places and strange lengths to find information. And I just thought there was an opportunity, well, not even just so much an opportunity, but almost a responsibility to put information out there that is easy to read and understand for the community, sort of steer them away from some of those darker places where they go looking for info. In addition, I really just enjoy the process of writing the posts. It's a win-win situation because I'm learning a lot, and hopefully the readers are getting something out of it. They can understand my gibberish. And I don't know, finally, it also just sort of satisfies a creative need, I suppose. I can have a lot of fun with the posts.
Okay, great. Well, I can tell you firsthand that it's definitely been a valuable source of information for me, and it has led me away from some of the darker places that are easy to find on the internet. So thank you for all that you do in that regard. And it was a need that I saw in some of my travels that I'd gone through, just because I saw some of the huge gaps that exist in the Parkinson's community, not only between researchers and patients, but also between researchers and physicians. I mean, I have met doctors who had never heard of iPS cells. And I've seen that your blog has had a pretty big impact on trying to bridge that gap between researchers and patients. But I'm wondering if you've noticed any kind of effect, any kind of similar effect between researchers and physicians or clinicians themselves.
With regards to my website?
Yeah, I mean, have you had doctors themselves reaching out to you and saying, wow, this has been a great source of information, or is it mainly just patients?
I've had all sorts reach out to me. I've had hedge fund analysts email me and ask me what I think about particular drugs.
Wow.
I've had, it's an interesting question. My primary focus is just on providing information for the patients and the carers. The best emails I get are from somebody sitting in the badlands of South Dakota saying, thanks, I never knew that so much research was going on. And it's certainly been eye-opening for me to read about all the research that's going on, because the sheer scale is quite mind-boggling, just the amount of research and all the different angles that we're looking at Parkinson's from. And to your question, I'm sort of off topic here, but while there's a lot of sort of specialized blogs out there, I have had a lot of researchers in the field contact me saying, yeah, great site, Thanks for pointing this out, or pointing that out. And also, can you highlight my research?
Okay. But would
most of my communication has been with the patient community, I suppose. So the direct answer to the question.
Okay, so it is having a much larger effect on patients than on physicians, but there is some spillover at least, right?
Yeah, there is.
Okay, good. So as you said, it's a joy to try and elucidate all of these different topics to people, but is there anything in particular that you found frustrating about trying to communicate science to the public?
Just simply the way a lot of what you write or say is completely taken out of context. I mean, I'm one of the more relatively optimistic researchers, I suppose, and that I think within my daughter's lifetime, we're going to make significant progress to the point of where this condition won't be such a problem for them. But a reader or a listener will take that and they'll just start contacting my boss, Roger Barker, saying, "Hey, Simon's saying we're going to cure Parkinson's tomorrow." And it's just when things are taken out of context, that's probably the most frustrating aspect.
Okay. Talking a little bit more about that darker part of the web that we mentioned before, I mean, there's a great need in the media to try and simplify some of these incredibly complex issues that we deal with. But in doing so, a lot of it is done by people who aren't nearly as qualified as you to actually disseminate this information. Do you think that with all these headlines that we see in the news, these over-exaggerated claims that are almost constantly made, do you think that ultimately the media helps or hurts the PD community?
I think the mass media needs to look itself in the mirror. But in general, the community, with the research at the moment, is moving further and further away from derivatives of dopamine therapies. And we're taking on some pretty complicated experimental approaches in the clinic. And in order for individuals to make informed decisions as to whether they want to partake in a clinical study, we have to provide them with more information than simply what's available via the mass media. And there is a desperate need, I think, to bridge the gap between the complicated research article and the crazy headlines that you see in the newspapers. But as you say, they are extremely complicated topics, and it's very easy for a lot of the misinformation or misinterpretation to come out of what is written on both ends.
I'm wondering if you have any advice for people who read some of these headlines, and let's say they come across a particular headline, and they're not sure whether, or they don't know how much faith to put in it. Do you have any advice for people in that situation? Like, what would you tell somebody who presents you a certain piece of information and says, "Should I believe this or not?"
Seek a second opinion. Even if you read something on our website, seek a second opinion. Einstein said it. We don't go from fact to fact. We go from assumption to assumption with science. And I think it was Einstein. I'm questioning myself now. But yeah, just seek a second opinion, get as much information as you can. And a lot of the research will relate to groups of people with Parkinson's as opposed to single individuals. And one major push now is to actually treat people on an individualized basis. And in that regard, everybody's got to be very proactive, I think, and try and find out as much about themselves as they can. So a lot of what you read and hear in the mass media might not necessarily relate to you yourself. I'm sort of deviated from your question there slightly.
No, I think that really hits at the point. It's about making sure that you don't take information that's meant for the general public and applying it to each individual case. I think that's very salient. Which actually kind of brings me to my next question that I wanted to ask, which is really just about the topic of complexity itself. I mean, your blog does a great job of taking these incredibly complex issues and making them slightly less complex without really dumbing them down. What advice do you have for others who are trying to communicate science, or anybody who's really trying to communicate these kind of complex issues to the public?
Well, firstly, you're very kind to say these things about the site. But with regards to advice, firstly, determine who your reader is. Try and work out who you want your reader to be. It might change over time, but if you want your reader to be mum and dad or grandma, or if you want your reader to be colleagues in the field, there's certainly space for all sorts of content and all sorts of websites and blogs. And also try and determine your own expectations. I think that we live in a celebrity sort of status world, and I've certainly got no agenda with regards to that. If anything, the older I get, the more invisible I want to become. But I think there are some people who go into this with, you need to be sure about why you're doing it. Avoid any personal opinions. Even if you don't necessarily agree with the science, deep down, you're sharing this information, you're sharing the consensus with the community. And the other don't is don't give any medical advice. I'm a research scientist. It's an easy out for me because I'm a research scientist, so I can just, whenever, it's the most common email I get. Tell me what I should do, and I just respond with, I'm a research scientist, I can't provide any sort of medical advice. And even if you were a clinician, it would be sort of unethical for you to provide advice if you don't know the person's medical history. So that was that. That's four bits of advice.
Okay.
I think that'll do for me.
Very good advice. To get into a little bit more of Parkinson's specific questions, your lab works on cell replacement therapy, and there's been some recent headlines that were made from Ireland, from attempts to kind of introduce cellular scaffolding to cell replacement therapy. Do you know if that's something that your lab or others are considering, and what do you make of that approach?
Well, firstly, it's not my lab, it's Roger's lab. And with regards to sort of taking this stuff to the clinic, taking cell transplantation to the clinic is such an enormous ordeal. Getting everything past the regulators takes such a long time that a lot of this new stuff that's popping up is not going to be part of the initial thrust. You have to go through what's called good lab practice, good manufacturing practice, GMP, GLP certification for a lot of these protocols and devices that we use, and it just takes forever. And to introduce something now would be an extra delay and an extra level of complexity. So while I think it's very exciting research and information and data, just introducing new things now is just too complicated. I think the first step will be to take a procedure like what we've been working on with ESL transplantation, take it to the clinic, see if it demonstrates efficacy, and then start to add extra variables in the longer term.
Okay, so it might be something we see in the far future, but not anytime soon.
Yeah, that would be my guess.
Okay. One big question that I've kind of been asking a lot along on my own journey here is, why is it so difficult for medical science to study the effects of more than one factor at a time? I mean, it seems as though any kind of research study works by taking this one single tiny factor and tweaking it and seeing its effects. But that's not how living bodies work. I mean, there's always multiple factors interacting at different times. Why is it so difficult for us to design these tests or design these studies to incorporate more than one factor?
I'm smiling here because just looking at one factor is extremely complicated. It depends on if you've got a particular protein that you're interested in looking at. It depends on the cells that you're going to look at it in, or if you've got a particular genetic mutation, we see different phenotypes. A phenotype is the sort of behavioral appearance of a genetic mutation. And we see differences between different strains of mice when we mutate a gene in one particular strain of mouse, it might be lethal, and in another strain of mouse, it might make them hyperactive. So just looking at single factors is extremely difficult in itself. But I think there is a push towards looking at multifactorial elements, especially in the clinical trials. The adaptive clinical trial approach is in vogue at the moment, and it's taking hold. The iSpy program in particular for cancer and Alzheimer's is certainly playing with it now. And the hope would be that we try something similar with Parkinson's. But yeah, I think to your question, it's just so difficult to analyze individual factors that taking on multiple factors is a great challenge.
Okay, I see. But at least it's good to know that it's something that people are seriously considering. I mean, I think I can understand to some degree some of the challenges involved. It just seems to me like such an obvious problem that we should be devoting more time to just because of how critical it is to living systems. But at least it is good to know that there are people seriously considering how to move forward with it.
Well, I mean, take an individual protein and it does different things at different times inside a cell. People who look at cell division, a protein will do one function at one particular stage of cell division and a different function at a different stage of cell division. And it's simply within the context of cell division, these are the functions that that particular protein has. And then if you change to a different type of cell, all of a sudden it's exhibiting completely new and novel functions. So we certainly want to look at things on a multifactorial basis, but just on an individual level, it's still extremely complicated.
Yeah, I guess when you put it like that, it really does make a lot of sense. I guess we have to wait for our computational models to get better, and then that'll make all of this a little bit easier, I guess.
If we take all the humans out of research and we just let the machines, the AI, take over, I think it'll be a lot easier.
Okay, well, let's hope that day comes soon enough. To if I could poke at your opinions a little bit. One of the, I guess, the biggest hot topics and then is one of the biggest topics in Parkinson's research, obviously, is alpha-synuclein. Would you hazard to guess whether you think it's a cause or effect of Parkinson's disease? Or is it, as I suspect anywhere, somewhere in between, whereas in some cases it's the cause, in some cases it's the effect, and it's a grayscale, it's not necessarily that black and white.
Yeah, it kind of goes back to that previous question. While I hope, I hope and pray that it is, because we've got all these clinical trials that are focused on it at the moment, and that could, you know, put all of us out of a job if it is the culprit. I think that the community needs to prepare itself at least for the idea that it isn't, or that it's more complicated than simply one protein. As a researcher, my job is to question everything, even dogma or consensus. So, yeah, I'm quite prepared to question whether alpha-synuclein is the main culprit. Plus, the brain is so complicated that I seriously doubt it's just down to one particular protein. If it was that simple, then we would just be too simple to understand it.
Well, at least it's good to know that there are people questioning the perceived dogma in the field. Another difficult one, another one that might be impossible to really properly answer, is how many different types of Parkinson's do you suspect there are? And where do you see the best attempts being made to try and create different subtypes of Parkinson's?
Well, I think it's dangerous for us to talk about Parkinson's as a singular condition. It's more of a syndrome, I suspect, of multiple conditions that exhibit very similar behavioral outputs or biological outputs. It's more of a syndrome than a disease in that case. One of the more interesting aspects, though, is the commonalities, though. If we start off with the idea that there are different subtypes, why is it that a lady up in Edinburgh can smell Parkinson's? What is it that we share across all the people with Parkinson's that allows her to be able to smell it? So it's not just the differences, but also the commonalities that are interesting. The best attempts to subdivide? I'm absolutely opposed to shameless self-promotion, but we have a very interesting study in the lab at the moment where we're sampling people's breath with some Israeli scientists. Professor Hassam Hayek's invented a clever way of analyzing chemicals within a volume of air. And we're getting some very interesting results, preliminary results from that study. That's a very user-friendly approach, whereas I worry that some of the other approaches, such as taking spinal fluid or blood, they're a bit invasive. And these are with regards to biomarkers, I should add. I think the genetics is certainly the most interesting area for me. We're now coming up with so many different variants. Every time I go and look for new journal papers, research papers on this topic of subtypes, we've got new genetic variants, rare genetic variants that suggest that everybody's different with regards to Parkinson's, and yet those genetic variants all sort of point towards similar biological processes going on inside the cell. As your previous guest, Professor Hardy, commented.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Well, hopefully progress will be made, and I look forward to hearing the results of that exciting sounding trial. I'd certainly much rather breathe into something than have somebody extract some of my spinal fluid. And then the last question that I wanted to ask you, though in some ways it might be the most important one, what do you see as some of the biggest barriers that stand in the way of progress? And what kind of changes do you hope to see in how science is done over the course of your career?
Oh man, that's two big questions. So I think with regards to barriers, everyone's probably going to tell you that it's funding and regulation and red tape, but I'd probably veer away from those obvious answers and suggest number one, just imagination. In scientific research, it's very easy for everybody to go chasing after the same topics. Everyone's interested in alpha-synuclein, for example, as we were talking about before. But what else is there? There's kind of a herd mentality with regards to a lot of the research effort, and there's almost a lack of imagination in it. The short-termism, we've got very short timeframes now, and there's a general concern, I think, that a lot of big projects can't be taken on because everything's working on such a short-term timeframe. Like Fred Sanger, would he have been able to do a lot of his work in the modern research funding system? I'm not sure, but and also sort of the evidence tail wagging the clinical dog scenario, we're making sort of marginal advances based on very small variations to our current stream of evidence, if that makes sense. Whereas There's very few people taking the big bold reckless steps, like the Barry Marshall swallowing a petri dish full of bacteria to prove that bacteria in your gut cause ulcers. That sort of spirit has largely disappeared almost, which is kind of sad. But having Having said that, there are efforts to counter it, and that there's groups like the Howard Hughes Institute, which go to the biggest and the best of the research community, and they say, here's a couple of $1 million, do whatever you want. And I think that's a fantastic endeavor. With regards to changes I'd like to see, where do I start? Number one, open access and open data. It just infuriates me to no end when I go looking for an old journal paper and I it's behind a paywall. I've got no access to it. And you can't email the researcher because if it's a paper from the 1960s or 70s, they've either retired or there's no PDF version of it anyway that they could send to you. So, open access is a big deal. That would give opportunity to citizen researchers if information and research was just full open access. And number two, more opportunities for career development for younger and sort of mid-level researchers. I'm not just speaking for myself there, but just in general, I worry that we're losing good people every single year. And science becomes just almost a filtering system for sociopaths like myself. there has to be a change in the structure and a better incentive system for folks to, number one, do the research and also stay in the research, because people come to research, they learn skills, they learn techniques, and then they disappear, and it's almost as if we lose all that information and all that expertise overnight. Those are two things I'd like to see changed.
Well, amen to both of those. And if you want to swallow a vial of alpha-synuclein, I'd applaud you for it. Though I don't know if I'd recommend
it. You're assuming that I haven't already.
Okay, well, thank you, Dr. Stott. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. You're welcome. I'm just going to turn off the recording here.